spiel. I'm excited about this work because one of the things that I am passionate about in my work is that is recognizing that there's an intersection between what we do at the community level and the work that we're trying to kind of promote around family violence. And so I think these guys represent that in a very good way. So I turn it on to turn it over to Master Vest, Joseph, okay? And kind of have him go there. Okay? Thanks.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming today. My name is Joseph Vess. I'm the Director of Training and Technical Assistance at Men Can Stop Rape. We are an organization based right around the corner from here in D.C. And the work that we do is, broadly speaking, looking at how we can engage men using masculinity to prevent violence against women specifically, but violence, all forms of male violence, broadly speaking. And today's discussion I'd like to have is about our work very specifically with minority institutions. And so we are funded by the United States Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health to work with minority-serving colleges and universities. And so what I'm going to talk a little bit about today is our work, broadly speaking, kind of our approach, and then narrow down into talking about our work with the Office on Women's Health and with minority institutions specifically. So I have my my disclosure form here. I don't have any disclosures. Sorry, it's the first time I presented at APHA. So this is just a little bit about our organization, and we talk about culture and creating cultures free from violence, because when we look at men's violence, we know that it does not happen in a vacuum. It is not individual men. It is not men who are bad or who have some kind of mental deficiency that commit violence against women. It is men from across all subsections of our society. And so what we talk about is how do we look at the cultures in which men's violence against women is allowed to happen, and the ways in which it happens, and the reasons in which men do not stand up and challenge violence against women when they see it. So our approach is based around a couple of things. One is the concept of primary prevention. How do we go back as far as possible to that violence and look at how we can stop it at its very roots? And one of the ways that we try and do that is by bringing a positive approach to this work. One of the things that men are used to hearing when we talk about, for instance, sexual assault, is that no means no, and that they need to not do certain things. We know the reality is that most men don't commit violence against women. And so when the only thing that we give them is no means no, we're not offering them any kind of positive action that they can take or any ways to constructively engage their friends, their community, or their society around prevention of violence against women. So what we're looking at with them is what's the yes piece? What is the yes things that these men can do in order to create healthier societies? And we know to do that, it has to be sustainable, because I work a lot with college students, and by the time I get to meeting a college student, they've already had 18 years at least of messaging about what it means to be a man and how men relate to women. And a lot of those messages are really negative, and I can't undo those in a week or a month, and often not even in a year. And so it has to be a long-term process of engaging men in order to really effectively do this. And the way that we found is most effective is by talking about masculinity, is by talking with men about what it means to be a man, what are the messages they've gotten about what it means to be a man, where they got those messages about what it means to be a man, and then looking at the negative ones and critically examining them, but then also looking at the positive ones. There's a lot of positive messages that men have gotten in their lives that they don't really recognize as positive messages, and that they haven't celebrated or appreciated and don't really know what to do with. And so what we look at is how can we use those positive messages to effectively mobilize men to create these societies free from violence. And so as we think about this as kind of, wow, that didn't come out well. When we think about this as a public health issue, a lot of my colleagues, and I think many people in the field of that I work in, we don't come into this with a huge public health background or a tremendous amount of public health understanding, but it kind of just snuck up on me, at least, with things like the social ecological model, which very much inform all of the work that we do on a day-to-day basis. We know that to do effective violence prevention, we have to be engaging men at all of these different levels, individual, relationship, community, and society, because otherwise it's not going to get done. If we only engage men on one or two or even three of these levels, we're not really going to be as effective as we would if we were engaging them on all of them. And so our work tries to encompass all of these different aspects through Men of Strength Club, which is what I'm going to be talking a little bit more about, which is a year-long curriculum-based program for middle school, high school, and college age men and boys. We have a public awareness campaign, a couple of different ones. In particular, our Young Men of Strength campaign, which focuses on middle school students, and our new Where Do You Stand campaign, which is a bystander intervention campaign aimed at college students, and it's a skill-building campaign. And then in addition, we have our professional trainings and workshops so that we work with a wide variety of different people from colleges, the military, youth serving institutions, mental health institutions, public health institutions to provide the skills that they need to effectively engage men around this. And part of that education when working in the public health sphere is by talking about how this is understood as a public health issue, because I think that historically a lot of people have had trouble making that connection. And so I think there's the obvious one about how any type of violence is a public health issue, right? If your health is negatively impacted by violence, that becomes a public health issue. But there's also the health promotion side. A lot of our work with Health and Human Services is around how can we get men to help support positive women's health objectives? How can we get men to help women access healthcare in a positive, collaborative way? Because that's something that most men have never really thought about. They don't really know how to do. Because the other piece of this is that a lot of men neglect our own personal health. And so if we're not in touch with our own health issues, it can be even more difficult to be in touch with health issues of women in our lives that we care about, whether it's partners, daughters, mothers, wives, whoever that might be. And then the other piece that is getting a lot more attention right now, I was at a conference sponsored by Awesome Women's Health last week, and there were a lot of folks from Futures Without Violence there talking about a new study and historic work that they've been doing around issues like reproductive health sabotage, birth control sabotage, and the way that reproductive health issues are adversely affected by family violence, by domestic violence. And so that's another really clear way that the issue of men's violence against women is a public health issue that I think is so important to talk about. And the other thing that I wanted to add about our Young Men of Strength campaign is that really tries to look at what are the behaviors that are going to lead to violence against women later. You know, we know that our middle schoolers are not committing a lot of domestic violence, but there's bullying that goes on in their hallways, there's harassment that goes on, there's even stalking behaviors that may go on. And so how do we address those behaviors at a really young age so that they don't become something worse further down the line? In terms of our approach and the way that we begin when we're working with men, there's a few key things I wanted to emphasize. One is we very much look at this as a strengths-based approach, right? What are the great things that men can do and already do, and how do we leverage those rather than looking at men's shortcomings and failings? We have to address those and deal with those, but it's really not the focus of our work. And so part of that is how do we expect the best from the men and boys that we work with? How do we hold them to a higher standard? Because in our experience, a lot of men want to be held to that higher standard, but they haven't before. We've heard the phrase, boys will be boys. I mean, that doesn't give men any room to grow. That doesn't give men any room to act in positive ways because so little is being expected of them. And so it's up for them to normalize that positive behavior and be role models for their community, but they also need those role models. And in many cases, I think it's important to emphasize, they have those role models in their community, but they don't acknowledge them as such. They're not really aware about the role models in their lives. And so when we have these conversations with men and boys, it can take a little while for them to realize, oh yeah, you know, my uncle is a really positive role model because he does X and Y and Z, and I never really thought about that. Or, you know, my baseball coach or my chemistry teacher or my dad, whoever it is. And so it's really about bringing these things to light and then building on them and seeing how we can use that to create these more positive, healthy societies. So in terms of our work with the Office on Women's Health, the focus has really been on developing men's capacity as allies with women on campus and then in their lives broadly. We know these young men are going to be going out into the world, and we want the messages that we share with them and that become part of their work there to stick with them. And so it's the focus has been on providing training and technical assistance for the faculty and staff that work with these men, and then on the sustainability side, in establishing campus Men of Strength clubs on each of the campuses that we work with so that there is institutional buy-in from faculty, staff, and students to do this, so that it's a really holistic package. We found that, obviously, without students, you can't do this, but in our experience of running these clubs in a variety of different settings, without faculty and staff buy-in, it's really hard to make a club like this successful. I know there's a lot of different college-based programs that are just student-run, and we haven't seen a whole lot of programs that engage men at the college and university level that are only student-run. And so the focus of our work with them is, again, twofold. How do we prevent violence against women on campus in all of its different forms? And then how do we help men support women's access to health care? And the kind of opening that we go in through that is with supporting survivors in their lives. One of the first questions that we'll ask a group of young men at a training is, how many of you have a woman in your life who has experienced some form of violence against women, sexual assault or domestic violence? And just about every hand goes up. Because a lot of these guys have women in their lives, sometimes very recently, sometimes back home, wherever it is, that have experienced this. And so that's a way to tie this in terms of how they can support women accessing health care. And then we want to broaden that to their understanding of HIV, AIDS, and other kinds of STI testing, right? Basic services like mammograms, cervical cancer scans, things like that. How can they be supportive partners, friends, whatever it is, with the women in their lives accessing these kinds of services. And so our work currently right now works with 5 HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, 2 tribal colleges, and 2 Hispanic-serving institutions. And these are all across the country from Norfolk, Virginia, to Bellingham, Washington, and down to El Paso, Texas. So it's a really wide, diverse group of folks. And we've really had a great time working with them. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that these groups face in kind of effectively doing this work. Funding and turnover and staffing are really tied in together. A lot of minority colleges and universities are chronically underfunded, and a lot of the folks that we work with there at the staff level are doing what at many universities would be the jobs of 3 or 4 people. And so trying to find space to integrate this work on top of the stuff that they're already doing is difficult, but there is a lot of passion. There's a lot of interest in doing this. It's just about finding the time and the resources to do that. Another thing that's important to talk about, especially with minority institutions, is the issue of intersecting oppressions. Is with minority students, they're already dealing with a lot of other kinds of issues that are playing on them. So racism, right? Socioeconomic oppression. A lot of the students that we work with come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And the issues that are affecting them in those spheres connect with the masculinity and the violence against women discussions that we have, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But it's essential to include that in the discussion, because otherwise we're missing out on big aspects of these young men's lives, because that's a very real thing for them. And it also opens the door to make connections by talking about how a young man, a young African-American man experiences racism. We're also able to talk about how women experience sexism from men. And those kinds of parallels are really easy for a lot of the students that we work with to see. And then the other thing that I'll add is non-traditional student bodies, commuter students, older students. There are different places in their lives. They have different priorities. A lot of the students that we work with are working 1 or 2 jobs outside as well. And so it's extremely important to look at how we can connect this with their lives outside of the institution that they're a part of, because they, I would say more so than a lot of students we work with at bigger, more prestigious majority institutions, they're very focused on college and are able to kind of block out some of that stuff where we've seen it. It's a lot more difficult for students at the minority institutions we work with to do that. They don't often have that luxury. In terms of some of the things that have worked really well for us and that we've had a lot of success with, at many of the schools we work with, there's a very strong school or group identity that's a part of these young men's lives. And a lot of that stems also from strong community connections. Thinking about especially some of the tribal colleges that we work with, the university is a community institution. There's very deep connections to the tribe, with the university, with people that live in the surrounding area. And so that provides a lot of additional support for doing this work in that sphere. There's a lot more people invested and interested in this, and a lot more opportunities for intergenerational dialogue as well, in terms of these young men getting mentoring from older men in the community, but then also providing mentoring for younger men in the community as well. The staff at these schools often have a very deep connection to them. They tend to come from the communities that we're working with, and whether that's the physical community in the area, or whether it's the broader community that the university is a part of. And another thing that I found was really interesting when we started working with these schools is that many groups are already having a discussion about masculinity. They're already engaged in this, and I'm thinking about, in particular, one of our schools is Florida A&M University, and when we started working with them about a year ago, we found that there was already a counselor in the counseling center who was having discussions with the students that he worked with about masculinity. And so what we did then in working with him was, how do we bring a gender lens to the discussions that you're having about what it means to be a man of Florida A&M in the community, an African-American man in society? And so what we did is try and bring a broader gender lens to that discussion. How do you integrate that into what it means, and how do we talk about men's relationships with women in a way that is really going to be positive and holistic and sustainable in that kind of way? And we've seen a lot of other institutions are having that kind of discussion in a way that, again, a lot of majority institutions I don't really believe are. It is happening, in my experience, in a lot of individual little pockets, but very rarely in a deliberate way, and very rarely in a way that is connecting with a large group of students. One of the other ways that we bring this into the discussion with the universities that we work with is by talking about how masculinity relates to other aspects of the university's life and the student lives as well. So there's the obvious way that we talk about violence in terms of how men's violence is seen in society and how it's used in society and how that relates to the campus climate. There's been a lot of discussion lately at colleges and universities about Title IX and the climate that is created by the presence of violence against women on campus. And so this is a really big discussion right now. And then also with community relations, how the students are perceived off campus by the people around them. One of the things that we've been talking about lately relates to graduation and retention rates. In particular, there was a great study that was done. This was a few years back, and it was in the Journal of College Student Development, published by ACPA, and it talked about the way that young men often will not seek academic help in certain subjects because their masculinity is very much tied to, well, I don't need to seek help. They talk about, in particular, young men who come from single-parent households where they might have been the quote-unquote man of the house when they were growing up. And so they see themselves, they see it as a pride thing. I don't need to go ask for help. I can do it on my own. And so it was talking about how that was an impediment. So something that had been a real strength for a lot of these young men for many years, now is becoming an impediment to them graduating and successfully matriculating through college. And so how do we look at that, and how do we acknowledge the strength that it's taken them all throughout this time to get to where they are? And now the strength is being turned against them. How do we help them get through that? And I think it's important to note, this plays out differently in different places, but that issue is not specific to African-American men. I mean, I can relate to doing the same thing when I was in college, not going to get help when I needed to. I just thought I'd figure it out. I thought I could get to it. I didn't need to ask for help. But as a white middle-class person at a majority institution, I had a bigger safety net than a lot of these young men had. I already had a lot of people looking out for me, whereas some of the men who are already academically underprepared, who may be coming from single-parent households, they don't have necessarily the safety net that a lot of other students do. And so we need to work with them around the masculinity piece so that they feel comfortable and realize that, hey, going in and asking for help does not make me less of a man to do that. It is not a sign of weakness to do that. It's actually a sign of strength. And that's really what all of our work is about how do we flip that understanding of strength to be something else. The strength is so often historically associated with physical strength or the strength to be tough and that kind of thing. But when we talk with young men about strength, the definitions that they tend to give us are often very different. They talk about the strength to do the right thing, to look out for other people, to be a caring member of your community, things like that. And we get those answers really, really across the board. And I think it's so important to acknowledge that that's what men hunger for and that's what men are really looking for, because our strength as an organization is really not in going in and saying, well, this is what you need to do and that's the kind of masculinity you should value. Because, you know, I'll be honest, I mean, I'm from the South, but I'm not from the Deep South like Tallahassee. And so if I go to Florida A&M, right, and I'm working with a number of young African-American men from the Florida Panhandle, my North Carolina-ness is not going to help, really. I mean, we still really do not have that much in common. And so our role as an organization is to come in there, provide a framework to have this discussion, say, look,
this is how we talk about masculinity with a wide number of men in all kinds of different settings. This is a way that you can begin to have this conversation with men. But we really rely on the dedicated faculty and staff at these institutions to push that discussion forward, to make it culturally appropriate, to make it geographically appropriate, and that's how that change happens, and then we provide support throughout that process. So the facilitator of the Most Club will have a discussion with these guys and have a meeting and talk with them, and then we'll have a conference call with them, and we'll talk about how that went and provide support on an ongoing basis through there. So there's really, on the ground, our staff, there's really only so much we can do. But what our strength really is again, providing the frameworks to support this discussion and to build that sustainability over a long period of time. In terms of some of the best practices that we've found and what we've seen really works well at a lot of these institutions, you know, peer involvement and promotion is absolutely essential. It's got to have a huge buy-in from the students that are involved, and they have to really talk it up among their friends. It's not going to be successful, as I said before, without faculty and staff, but it's definitely not going to be successful without students feeling like they're really a part of it. It also has to start early. It has to happen all the time. And it has to be consistent in terms of the way that it's done. What we found is that if men get a lot of kind of muddled messages around this, it often becomes an excuse to not do anything. It becomes an excuse not to participate. And so what we talk with them about is how do we have this as a constant presence on a campus throughout the year. Another thing is about inviting and bringing positive marketing into this. At a lot of the schools we work with, there's a nomination process for students to participate. It's not an exclusive nomination process. You can still participate if you're not nominated, but we want men to feel like, hey, this is an honor to be a part of this. This is something that somebody is asking me to do because they believe in me. They believe in who I am. They believe that I can do good things. And we found that is really successful. And then also provide opportunities for men to do more. Again, men are so used to getting messages about what not to do. It's really the important thing for us is how do we tell them as much as possible, here's what you can do. There are lots of things you can do about this, and here are some of the many things that you can do. Just a little bit more about kind of our programming and what it looks like on any given campus. It's, as I said, a year-long program. It's curriculum-based, and the curriculum is similar at all the levels, middle school, high school, and college, but then obviously more specific for the groups that we're working with. At college, there's a lot more discussion about relationships and serious relationships, drug and alcohol abuse, going out into the world after they graduate, getting a job, how this relates to you once you get out of college, and what that discussion looks like. At each of our schools that we work with at any age level, it's always a core group. Our goal is not to get every man on campus involved. It's about getting a cross-section of men from the campus to participate so that they can then reach out to their peer groups and bring them in so that they can play a role. Again, a faculty or staff facilitator. It's activities and exercises combined with kind of free-form discussion. There's a place for men to kind of just talk in a less structured way many times because a lot of men don't have that opportunity. There's also skill building. One of the things that a lot of men struggle with, even members of the group, is, well, how do I talk with other guys about this? And so there's a big skill-building component, both formally and informally. There's, you know, peer education training, but then there's also discussion, well, how do I talk to my roommate about this? You know, I'm not going to go home and give him a presentation, but how do I call him out when he uses language that I feel is inappropriate? And then regular campus programming that the group coordinates and the group participates in at the very least on a regular basis. And finally, the other thing that I wanted to talk about is our evaluation protocol. We've had an evaluation in place for a number of years at the high school level, and over the last 2 years, we've been expanding it to the college and middle school levels. And so we've done a lot of work in the last 2 years about our college evaluation and what that looks like and gathering data through pre- and post-tests. And right now we're having discussions with CDC, Research Triangle Institute, and Robert Wood Johnson Foundation about expanding that into what we're hoping is going to be a 5-year longitudinal study of students that have participated in these clubs, especially across these different sections. Because we do have young men now. We've been running our high school clubs for 10 years. So we have young men who have been in this club for 4, 5, 6, 7 years even, when you look at middle school to high school or high school to college. And so we want to look at what's the impact that this has had on their lives. How has it affected them? What are the ways that they've used this to become better men? And yeah, I think that's everything. Okay. Sorry, I wanted to make sure I got everything in time. Am I good? Okay. thank you all very much for coming, and I'll be sticking around for a few minutes afterwards, so I'd love to talk with anyone who would like more details or has more interest in this. So, thanks.